This is Audible.
Audible presents this brilliance audio production of
Behind the Lines by W.E.B. Griffin. Copyright 1996 by W.E.B. Griffin and performance copyright 1996 by Brilliance Corporation. All rights reserved. Note to the listener. Probably the best-known Marines who served with great distinction behind the enemy's lines with the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, during World War II are Major Pete Ortiz, who was decorated with two Navy Crosses and named a member of both the French Légion d'Honneur and the British Order of the British Empire for his valor, Sergeants Jack Reisler and Fred Brunner, Gunnery Sergeant Robert LaSalle, and Captains Sterling Hayden, the actor, and Peter DeVries, the writer. There were others. The Corps is respectfully dedicated to the memory of 2nd Lieutenant Drew James Barrett III, USMC, Company K, 3rd Battalion, 26th Marines, born Denver, Colorado, 3 January 1945, died Quang Nam Province, Republic of Vietnam, 27 February 1969, and Major Alfred Lee Butler III, USMC, Headquarters, 22nd Marine Amphibious Unit, born Washington, D.C., 4 September 1950, died Beirut, Lebanon, 8 February 1984, and to the memory of Donald L. Schomp, a Marine fighter pilot who became a legendary U.S. Army Master Aviator. Rest in peace. 9 April 1989. Semper Fi. Behind the Lines by W.E.B. Griffin. Part 1. 1. Headquarters, U.S. Army Luzon Force, Bataan Peninsula, Luzon, Philippines. 0915 hours, 7 April 1942. A Ford pickup truck turned off the Miravalles-Cabcaban Highway into what was officially called the headquarters area, but known universally as Little Baguio. The area held, in flimsy tropical buildings, the main ordnance and engineer depots and General Hospital No. 1, as well as the collection of buildings that housed the various offices of headquarters, U.S. Army Force, Luzon. The truck had seen better days. Its fenders were crumpled, its windshield was cracked, and the bright crimson paint of its former life as a utility vehicle for the Coca-Cola Company of Manila showed in 20 places through a hastily applied coat of Army olive drab. On the truck bed were a footlocker, a folding wooden cot, a battered leather suitcase, and half a dozen 5-gallon gasoline cans. In a few moments, it pulled up beside the building identified by a battered sign as the Commanding General's. A tall, just this side of heavy-set man got out of the truck and started to walk toward the building. He was wearing must, sweat-soaked khakis, high-topped shoes, and a web belt from which was suspended a Model 1911 Colt 45 ACP pistol. He stopped and returned to the truck, snatched a khaki overseas cap from the seat, and put it on. On the cap was the gold leaf of a major. There was no insignia of any kind on his khaki shirt. He rubbed the red stubble on his cheeks.
I need a shave. To hell with it.
He entered the open-sided building and walked past a collection of desks toward the building's rear, stopping before the desk of another major of about the same age. On the desk, an ornately carved triangular nameplate, a remnant of better times, carried the crossed rifles of infantry, a major's leaf, and the legend, Marshal Hurt. A moment or so later, Major Hurt looked up.
Fertig, he said. What can I do for you?
I was sent for, Fertig replied.
Oh, yes. I'd forgotten, Hurt said.
They didn't particularly like each other. Hurt was a professional soldier, Wendell Fertig a reservist. A year before, Hurt had been an underpaid captain and Fertig a successful and wealthy civil engineer. Hurt stood up from his desk and went deeper into the building. A minute later, he returned.
The general will see you now, he said, and nodded toward the rear of the building.
Fertig nodded, walked to an open door, then stood there and waited to be noticed by Major General Edward P. King, Jr., the commanding general of Luzon Force. King,
a stocky, 58-year-old artilleryman from Atlanta who wore a neatly cropped full mustache was at that moment standing before a sheet of plywood on which a large-scale map of the Bataan Peninsula had been mounted. Fertig both liked and admired General King. He had known him socially before the war. Indeed, General King had played an important role in the direct commissioning of Fertig as a captain, Corps of Engineers, U.S. Army Reserve. And right now, he felt very sorry for him. Fertig didn't pretend to know much about the Army, but he knew enough to understand that the worst thing that could happen to a career officer was to suffer defeat. The map of Bataan General King was studying was clear proof that not only was he suffering defeat, but the defeat was very shortly going to be total and absolute. It didn't matter that King was going to be defeated by a well-equipped, battle-hardened Japanese force that outnumbered King's poorly equipped, starving, Phil-American force 4 or 5 to 1. He was about to lose, and that was all that mattered. A minute or so later, General King glanced at the door, noticed Fertig, and waved him inside. "Wendell," he said.
"General?"
"Could you see the map where you were standing?" Fertig nodded.
"I'm afraid it won't be long," King said.
"You know how we are defining effectives these days, Wendell?" Fertig shook his head no. "An effective soldier is one who can carry his weapon 100 yards without resting and be capable of firing it after he has gone the 100 yards. 15% of our force is effective as of yesterday. The percentage is expected to decline." Fertig nodded. "I had several things on my mind when I sent for you," General King said. "For one thing, I wanted to hear from you personally that we are prepared to destroy our ordnance and other stocks."
"Everything is prepared for detonation, General, redundantly in terms of both hardware and personnel. In other words, each blow site has been doubly wired, and there are 2 locations from which the sites can be blown."
King nodded. "Thank you. Good job. A young lieutenant came up with a means to destroy artillery that somehow didn't occur to the authors of the field manuals. You simply shove powder bags down the tube ahead of the charge, or the round, and then fire it."
"I don't suppose the authors gave a lot of thought to destroying our own cannons," Fertig said. "I was going to suggest shoving sandbags down the barrel from the muzzle end. I don't know how it would work with a cannon, but I do know, from painful experience, what happens to the barrel of a Diana-grade Browning when you try to get an 1.25 of No. 6 shot past a lump of mud."
King smiled. It was a memory of better times, of a cock pheasant rising from the frozen stubble of a cornfield.
"Secondly, Wendell, I was wondering what to do with you."
"Sir?"
"You've blown up, or arranged to blow up, everything here that has to be blown," King said. "It occurred to me that General Sharp might find some use for your skills."
Brigadier General William F. Sharp commanded, on the island of Mindanao, what was now known as the Mindanao Force of the U.S. Army in the Philippines. From everything Fertig had heard, Sharp's forces had not been subjected to the same degree of attack as the Luzon force, and so were in much better shape. In the absence of reinforcements, Sharp's forces were as inevitably doomed as King's, but that defeat was some time off, perhaps as much as 2 months, and in 2 months a good deal could happen.
"Yes, sir."
"Would you be willing to go down there to him?"
"Yes, sir, of course."
"Well, we have some small craft that periodically try to get from here to there. There's one leaving at nightfall. I've told Hurt to find space for you on it."
"Yes, sir."
"Possibly, Wendell, you could make it from Mindanao to Australia."
"God knows.
It would be a waste of your talents to spend the rest of this war in a prisoner of war cage."
"If you think I can be of any use here, General, I think we've passed that point, Wendell. And I'm sure General Sharp will be glad to have you. Give him my best regards when you see him."
"Yes, sir."
"That'll be all, Wendell," King said. He put out his hand. "You've carried your weight around here. Thank you.
I'll see you after the war." "It's been a privilege serving under you, sir."
Fertig saluted. King returned it. Fertig did as crisp an about-face movement as he could manage, and then marched toward the door. His throat was tight. He felt like crying.
Wait a minute,
General King called after him. Fertig turned. I said there were several things on my mind, King said. I forgot one.
Yes, sir.
King motioned him to approach.
This used to be done with the photographers with a proudly beaming wife standing by and would be followed by a drunk at the club at your expense, King said. No clubs, no photographers, and no wife, thank God. But congratulations nonetheless, Colonel.
He handed Fertig a Lieutenant Colonel's silver leaf.
I'll be damned, Fertig said.
Well earned, Wendell, King said, and shook his hand. I'll hold you to the party in better times.
I'll look forward to it, sir.
King grabbed Fertig's shoulder, squeezed it, smiled, and then turned away from him. Fertig left the office and returned to Major Hurt's desk.
Tell me about the boat, he said.
It's a small coaster, Hurt replied. Be at the pier at Maravillas at 5:30. They expect you.
Do I need orders, or...
You're traveling VOCG, Hurt said. Verbal order of the commanding general. Technically, you're on temporary duty from Luzon Force to Mindanao Force. We don't have authority to transfer anyone.
Okay.
I'll need your truck, Hurt said. So far as luggage is concerned, one item of luggage.
I've got a suitcase and a footlocker.
One or the other. Sorry.
Well, then, I'll leave the footlocker here with you for safekeeping.
Hurt smiled.
I love optimists, he said. Sorry, there really is no room on the boat.
If it's all right with you, Hurt, I'll take the footlocker to one of the ammo dumps and then bring the truck back, of course. There's some personal stuff in there I'd much rather see blown up than fall into the hands of some son of Nippon.
May I offer you a piece of advice?
Certainly.
You're a lieutenant colonel now. You don't have to ask a major for permission to do anything.
I'll try to remember that, Fertig said.
He put out his hand.
So long, Hurt. Take care of yourself.
Yeah, you too, Hurt said. And just for the record, I think you deserve that silver leaf.
Whoa, if there was anything left to drink around here, I'd think you'd been at it.
If there was anything left to drink around here, I would be at it, Major Hurt said. Good luck, Colonel.
See you after the war, Major.
Part 2 1 Headquarters, 4th Marines, Malinta Tunnel, Fortress Corregidor, Manila Bay, Commonwealth of the Philippines. 0915 hours, 1 April, 1942. Major Stephen J. Paulson, USMC, a slightly built 32-year-old from Chicago who was acting S1, personnel officer, 4th Marines, had been giving a good deal of thought, much of it uncomfortable, even painful, both to his own future and to the future of 1st Lieutenant James B. Weston, USMC. Paulson had been a Marine for 11 years and a naval aviator for 8, but he had spent almost 2 years as an infantry platoon leader before going to Pensacola for flight training. So when push came to shove, by which he meant when the Japanese landed on Fortress Corregidor, he thought he could probably do some good, at least hold his own as an infantry officer. Not in duties commensurate with the gold oak leaves on his collar points, nor even as a captain commanding a company, but he remembered enough about leading a platoon to be useful when the Japs came. On the other hand, in his view, Lieutenant Weston would not. This was not a criticism of Weston, simply a statement of fact. Weston came into the Corps right out of the University of Iowa, went through a sort of boot camp for officers at Quantico, and immediately went to Pensacola for pilot training. He was an aviator, and a pretty good one, but he really wasn't qualified to be a platoon leader. Not that that would matter to the overall efficiency of the 4th Marines. There were more than enough fully qualified infantry lieutenants and captains around, both among the officers who came to the Philippines when the 4th Marines were moved from Shanghai, and among those, like Paulson himself and Weston, who joined the regiment because they'd been in the Philippines filling billets that no longer existed.
Before the war, Major Paulson had been aviation officer on the staff of the commanding officer, Marine Barracks, Cavite Naval Station, and had commanded a staff sergeant and a PFC. There had not been much for any of them to do, except on those rare occasions when a carrier with a Marine squadron aboard actually pulled into Cavite. Then there was frantic activity for several days, doing what he could to pry necessary parts and supplies loose from the steel grip of Navy supply officers, arranging for the sick to be admitted to shore medical facilities, and trying for the release from the brig of those Marines who had somehow run afoul of the shore patrol in time for them to sail with the carrier. In those days, he had spent a lot of his ample free time trying to come up with a good reason to ask for a transfer back to flying duties. That was a delicate area. Marine officers are supposed to go where they are sent and do what they are told to do without complaining or trying to get out of it. Ordinarily, Paulson would not have tried to get himself out of Cavite. It was a 3-year tour, and when it was over, he could expect a flying assignment. But he didn't think the war, he considered inevitable, was going to wait for him to complete his tour, so he tried to get out of it. He had absolutely no success. A visiting colonel gave him a discreet word to the wise. Obviously, the Corps had to have someone ashore at Cavite, and he was selected. It was not acceptable behavior for a Marine officer to try to get out of an assignment he didn't like. Lieutenant Jim Weston's case was somewhat different from his own. After a 2-year tour with a Marine fighter squadron flying Brewster Buffalo F-2As, he had been selected for multi-engine training. After transition training, he had been given a 6-month assignment to a Navy squadron flying consolidated PBY-5A Catalina twin-engine flying boats. The idea was to give him enough time under experienced Navy aviators so that he could return to the Corps and serve as a multi-engine instructor pilot. That, in turn, meant someone had judged him to be a better-than-ordinary pilot, skilled and mature enough to become an IP, and not, as Weston felt, because he hadn't been able to cut the mustard as a fighter pilot. 3 months into his utilization tour at Pearl Harbor, the Japanese attacked. Though many of the planes of the Navy squadron to which Weston was attached were destroyed on the ground, Weston flew, as co-pilot, one of the few remaining Catalinas to Cavite on a courier flight. The Japanese also attacked Cavite, destroying on the ground other Navy Catalinas, one of which had been flown to the Philippines by a Pearl Harbor-based lieutenant commander. When Lieutenant Weston's Catalina landed at Cavite, the lieutenant commander judged that he could be of far greater value to the war effort back in Pearl Harbor than a lowly Marine lieutenant on loan to the Navy. And when the Catalina took off, he was at the controls and Weston was left behind, awaiting transportation. Weston hadn't been in a cockpit since. There were few aircraft of any type left in the Philippines. When it became evident that his chances of returning to flying or of being evacuated to Pearl Harbor were negligible, he was assigned to the staff of the aviation officer, Paulson, of Marine Barracks, Cavite. When Cavite was blown up and left for the enemy, all remaining Marine personnel were transferred to the 4th Marines. Paulson was assigned to the personnel section, relieving a major who had served with the 4th Marines in China and whose infantry expertise could be put to better use, and Weston became his deputy. In Paulson's view, there was not much left for the acting personnel officer to do but wait for the Japanese to land on Corregidor, whereupon he would order the destruction of personnel records by thermite grenade, grab his rifle, and fight until the end as an overage, overranked platoon leader. There was only one alternative to this course of action, one that Paulson himself could not accept, but which, the more he thought about it, seemed to be a viable course of action for Lieutenant Jim Weston. Before the war, Paulson came to know a number of Army Air Corps pilots. One of them, an Army Air Corps major, also transferred to ground duty when there were no more airplanes for him to fly, approached him and announced that since the war here was about over and he had no intention of surrendering, he was going to head for the hills and hide out. From there, he would either try to escape to Australia, or maybe even fight as a guerrilla. You want to come along, Steve? He asked.
Paulson gave the offer a good deal of thought before declining. For one thing, it would be AWOL, or perhaps even desertion. Something about that rubbed him the wrong way. The very word, desertion, made him consider that since he still had some contribution to make, even if only as a platoon leader, he would in fact be deserting the enlisted men at a time when they needed him most. Finally, although he didn't like to face the fact, his health was shot. He had some sort of rash whose suppurating sores seemed to grow worse daily. His teeth were falling out. There was no way he could survive running around in the hot, physically debilitating jungles of the Philippines. He would become a burden to whomever he was with. Weston, however, was another matter. Although Paulson was sure he would try his best, the young pilot would be nearly worthless as a platoon leader. And maybe even worse, he could be a burden to those he was commanding. On the other hand, if Weston could somehow get out of the Philippines, he would be of great use to the Corps. There had been a pilot shortage before the war, and that shortage must, Paulson reasoned, be even more acute now. And even if Weston couldn't escape from the Philippines, he was young and, considering the circumstances, in good health. He could probably make himself useful to a guerrilla operation. For one thing, he had a degree in electrical engineering, which meant he probably knew something about radios. Any guerrilla force needed radios. The final consideration was very simple. If Weston stayed on Corregidor, one of two things was certain to happen. He would be killed, or he would be taken prisoner. It was equally certain that he would be more of a problem than an asset in the final fighting. If he went off into the hills, tried to escape to Australia, he would probably be killed. But he might not. He might escape. And if he did, he could make a contribution. Or he might be useful to some guerrilla commander. Paulson thought of his Air Corps friend who one day simply vanished from Corregidor, and make a contribution that way. On the Rock, the alternatives to death and or surrender were the subject of many careful, soft conversations between officers. Yet, as close as he and Paulson had become, Weston had never brought the subject up. Paulson wondered, is this because he's been thinking about it and is afraid I will order him to forget about it if he mentions it to me? Or because he thinks his duty is clear, to stay here and get killed or become a prisoner? And doesn't want me to think he's even thought about taking off? Finally, he later recognized this as one of the most difficult things he'd ever done in the Corps. Paulson brought the subject up to Weston himself, directly and somewhat forcefully. They were discussing Weston's alternatives, as possibilities Weston could choose, one possibility being to try to escape. But then Paulson stopped and changed that from a choice to something close to an order. And Weston accepted it as an order. Paulson wondered,
because he's a good Marine and obeys whatever order he is given, even one that frightens him? Or because he was on the edge of making that decision for himself, and my making it an order made it easier?
By then, none of this took more than a few days. Things were disintegrating at a rapidly accelerating pace. It was harder and harder to leave the island. The boats, the only means of crossing the 2 miles of water from the Rock to Bataan, were disappearing, partly as a result of enemy action, partly from lack of parts and maintenance, and partly, Paulson suspected, because they'd been requisitioned by people who were electing not to surrender when the end came. There seemed to be proof of that. The boats now carried guards to make sure they completed their intended trips. And getting permission to leave the island for any purpose now required the authorization of a colonel, or better. Solving that was an emotional problem for Paulson, not a practical one. As a paper pusher, he routinely signed colonels' names to all sorts of documents, including permission authority to leave the island. Sometimes he added his initials to these, sometimes not. He did not think his memorandum ordering Weston to Bataan on a supply-gathering mission would be questioned, but writing it was still one of the most serious violations of the officer's honor code, willfully uttering a document known to be false.
At 0900, he sent a runner after Lieutenant Weston, whom he had loaned to the Army finance officer. Weston and a half-dozen other officers had spent the past 3 days making lists, in triplicate, of the serial numbers of all the 100, 50, 20, and $10 bills in the possession of Army and Navy finance officers. When the lists were completed, the money would be burned to keep it out of Japanese hands. Attempts would be made to get the list somehow out of the Philippines.
There's no food and no medicine and damn little booze, but the Army and the Navy are loaded with dough,
Paulson thought with bitter amusement.
You wanted to see me, sir?
Weston asked. Paulson met the eyes of the young, unhealthily thin officer.
I've decided we should make one more attempt. You should make one more attempt to find the parts for our generator, Paulson said.
Aye, aye, sir,
Weston replied, trying but not quite succeeding to keep his face expressionless.
Here's your boat pass, Paulson said, handing him the authorization.
Yes, sir.
And the necessary funds, Paulson went on. You'll have to sign for them.
Aye, aye, sir.
Weston's eyes widened when he glanced into the envelope Paulson handed him. It was a thick stack of crisp, unissued $50 and $100 bills, far more money than was necessary to buy generator parts.
$5,000, Paulson said. Inflation seems to have come to this Pacific paradise.
Yes, sir,
Weston said, as he leaned over to sign the receipt on Paulson's desk.
There's supposed to be a motor pool on shore, Paulson said. You are authorized by your pass to draw a vehicle. You may or may not get one.
Yes, sir.
I've arranged for an interpreter to go with you. He's supposed to be fluent in Spanish. Pick him up at the headquarters company CP.
Aye, aye, sir.
Paulson had given a good deal of thought about the wisdom of sending an interpreter with Weston. On the one hand, it would reduce any suspicions about Weston's generator parts-finding mission. On the other, there was no way to predict how the interpreter, a buck sergeant who'd come to the Philippines with the 4th Marines from Shanghai, would react when he found out Weston was not going to return to the Rock. In the end, he decided in favor of sending the sergeant with Weston. Weston might be able to handle the sergeant. If so, the sergeant, with his knowledge of Spanish and because he was an old-breed China Marine, might be very useful when Weston took off.
And I think you'd better take this with you, Paulson said, taking from the well of his desk a Thompson 45 caliber submachine gun and two extra stick magazines. You never know when you might need it.
Aye, aye, sir.
Thank you, sir, Weston said.
He slung the Thompson's web sling over his shoulder, then put one magazine in each of his trousers' side pockets.
Don't shoot yourself in the foot with that, Mr. Weston, Paulson said, meeting his eyes. In other words, take care.
Aye, aye, sir.
Move out, Mr. Weston, Paulson said. Get your show on the road.
Weston said nothing for a long minute. Then he saluted. Paulson returned the salute and then extended his hand.
Good luck, Jim, Paulson said.
Good luck to you, sir,
Weston said. Then he came to attention.
By your leave, sir?
Paulson nodded. Weston made the about-face movement and marched away from Paulson's desk. Paulson watched him go down the lateral tunnel and then turn into the main tunnel. Then he turned his attention to the papers on his desk. 2. Kindley Field, Fortress Corregidor, Manila Bay, Commonwealth of the Philippines. 0920 hours, 1 April 1942. Sergeant Percy Lewis Everly, USMC, had spent most of the morning thinking very seriously about desertion. Everly, who was 26 years old, 6 feet tall, sharply featured, and weighed 145 pounds, was in charge of a two-gun, water-cooled, 30-caliber Browning machine gun section of Headquarters Company, 4th Marines. This was set up to train its fire on Kindley Field, a rectangular, cleared area toward the seaward end of Corregidor. The area had been cleared years before to serve as a balloon field. Everly had seen that on the map. The map didn't say what kind of balloons it was supposed to serve, whether barrage balloons, designed to interfere with aircraft attacking the island fortress, or observation balloons, from which the tip of the Bataan Peninsula 2 miles away could be observed. There had been no evidence of either kind of balloons, although Everly had come across the rusted remains of what could have been a winch for balloon cables. Everly, in his washed, thin khakis, web pistol belt, and steel helmet, looked skeletal. Part of that, of course, was because they were on one-half rations, and everybody had lost a lot of weight. But Everly, who from time to time had been called Slats, was never heavy, never weighed more than 160 pounds. The machine guns were set up in bunkers made from sandbags, sand-filled 55-gallon drums, and salvaged lumber. They would probably provide some protection against small arms fire and even hand grenades, but Everly knew the guns weren't going to get much protection from mortar fire or artillery. When the field telephone buzzed, Everly took it from its leather case and pressed the butterfly switch.
16, he said.
Everly!
A voice Everly recognized as the company clerk's asked.
Yeah?
The first wants you here. Now.
On my way,
Everly said, and put the telephone back in its case. He had a good idea what the first sergeant of headquarters company, 4th Marines, wanted with him. Because he spoke Spanish, he was in some demand as an interpreter if one of the officers had business on Bataan. Everly walked, stooping, across the bunker to where Corporal Max Schirmer, a short, no longer plump 23-year-old, was sleeping on a bunk of 2x4s and salvaged camo wire, and touched his arm.
You've got it, Everly said when Schirmer opened his eyes. They want me at the CP.
Schirmer nodded, then sat up and shook his head to clear it. When Everly was satisfied that Schirmer was really awake, he left the bunker and headed up the dirt path toward the company command post. Everly had been a Marine for almost 8 years. If the war hadn't come along, he would have been discharged at the conclusion of his second 4-year hitch on 25 May, 1942. But a whole year before that, on 27 May, 1941, when the 4th Marines were still in China, President Roosevelt had proclaimed an unlimited state of national emergency, one result of which had been the extension of all enlistments in the Marine Corps for the duration of the emergency plus 6 months. But that had really not meant much to Everly. He liked the Marine Corps, and he could not imagine doing anything but being a Marine. If his enlistment hadn't been extended, he would have shipped over, sewn a second 4 years service hash mark on the sleeves of his uniform, and gone on being a Marine. The only thing the date 25 May 1942 meant to Everly now was that, unless he did something about it, and soon, and the only thing he could think of doing was to desert, when it came around, and it was going to come around next month, he'd either be dead or wishing he was dead. Everly was pretty sure in his mind about three things. Number one, Bataan was about to fall. Number two, the aid was not coming, at least not in time to do any good. And because it wasn't, number three, soon after Bataan fell, Fortress Corregidor was going to fall. Bataan was a peninsula on what Everly thought of as the bottom of Luzon Island. It sort of closed off Manila Bay. Fortress Corregidor was an island in Manila Bay, 2 miles off the tip of Bataan, about 30 miles from the capital of the Philippines, Manila. Maps of Corregidor looked to Everly like the drawings Mr. Hawkins used to make of human sperm on the blackboard at Zanesville High School during what was called masculine hygiene. Everly graduated from Zanesville High School on 22 May 1934, went into the Corps 2 days later, and had not been back to Zanesville or even to West Virginia since. His father, a coal miner, died when Everly was 14. And his mother 2 years later. Since no relatives were either able or willing to take him in, the state boarded him out for 2 years with a foster family. Both the state and his foster mother took pains to make sure he understood he would be on his own the minute he was 18. He went to the post office in Wheeling one day in the first weeks of his senior year, intending to join the Navy and see the world, as the recruiting posters offered. But the Navy wouldn't have him, for reasons he no longer remembered, nor would the Army. But the Marine recruiter said he would accept his application, send it in, and see what happened. A month later, there was a letter with a bus ticket and meal vouchers. He went back to Wheeling and took a physical examination and filled out some more forms, and 2 weeks after that, there was another letter, this one from Headquarters, U.S. Marine Corps in Washington, D.C., telling him he had been accepted for enlistment and that since he was a minor, he would have to have his parents' permission to enlist, form enclosed, signature to be notarized. He got his foster father to sign it and mailed it off. But it came back, saying that since Everly was a ward of the state of West Virginia, it would have to be signed by the responsible official. That turned out to be the judge of probate. The judge signed the form and told him he thought he was doing the smart thing, shook his hand, and wished him good luck. Everly left Zanesville the morning after the day he graduated, took the bus to Washington, D.C., was given another physical at the Washington Navy Yard, and was sworn into the Corps that afternoon. He went through boot camp, and then they loaded him aboard the USS Chaumont and sent him to the Marine Barracks, U.S. Navy Base Cavite, outside Manila. That was good duty. The Corps put him to work in the motor pool, where he was supposed to be supervising the Filipino mechanics. But since the Filipinos knew a hell of a lot more about automobile mechanics than he did, what really happened was that they taught him, rather than the other way around. He also got himself a girl, a short, sort of plump, dark-skinned 17-year-old named Estelita, which meant little star, or something like that. Estelita had been raised as a Catholic. Every Sunday she went to confession because what they were doing, not being married, was a sin, and then to Mass, and then came home and got in bed with him again. Everly was very careful not to get her in the family way. He had only been an orphan 2 years before coming into the Corps, but that had been enough to convince him that making a baby that was going to be an orphan because you weren't going to marry the mother would be a lousy thing to do to anybody. Between Estelita and the little brown brothers in the motor pool, it wasn't long before he was speaking pretty good Spanish. And then he got promoted to private first class, and he considered that things were better for him in the Corps and in the Philippines than they had ever been so far in his life. Then he got in a fight at the Good Times bar with a sergeant from the Marine Detachment on the battleship USS Pennsylvania when she came into Cavite. The son of a bitch was a mean drunk. And when Everly knocked him on his ass the first time he put his hand on Estelita's breast and wouldn't stop, he came back at Everly with a knife, one of those kind that flick open when you press a button. And when the fight was over, both of them were cut, and the sergeant had a broken nose and a busted-up hand where Everly had stomped on it. Everly knew the fight wasn't his fault, but he also knew that he was a PFC, and the mean son of a bitch was a sergeant. When they put him before a general court-martial charged with attempted murder and assault with a deadly weapon upon the person of a superior non-commissioned officer, Everly decided that the other shoe had dropped, the good times were over, and he was going to spend the next 10 or 15 years in the Portsmouth Naval Prison. But that didn't happen either. They had the court-martial, and he stood up at attention and heard the senior officer, a lieutenant colonel, say that the court, in closed session, 2/3 of its members concurring, had found him not guilty of all the charges and all the specifications. The next day, the commanding officer of Marine Barracks, Cavite, called him in and told him that it was his experience, in circumstances like this, that it was best for everybody if the accused found not guilty was transferred. Then he went on and said Everly could have his choice. He could be reassigned to some place like San Diego in the States, or aboard a ship, or, and this is what he would recommend, to the 4th Marines in Shanghai. So 3 weeks later, Everly went aboard the USS Chaumont when she called at Cavite and rowed her to Shanghai, China, where he was assigned to Headquarters Company, 4th Marines, and detailed to the motor pool. Within a couple of weeks, he could see that being a China Marine was going to be even better duty than Cavite.
Not only that, nobody seemed to know about what he did to that mean, drunk son of a bitch off the Pennsylvania and about the court-martial. He was sure that Sergeant Zimmerman, who ran the motor pool, didn't know anything about it. And while it seemed likely that somebody, maybe his first sergeant or his company commander, or maybe even the regimental commander, knew about it, nobody was holding it against him. He really had come here with a clean slate. That made him feel pretty good again about the Corps and being in the Corps. He turned 21 in Shanghai and signed the papers extending his, until reaching his legal majority or unless sooner discharged, enlistment for a 4-year hitch. And then, in May 1938, he shipped over for another 4 years. At the time, he thought that with a little bit of luck, he might make corporal during his second hitch. He got himself a Chinese woman, Su Ling, and she took care of him and taught him to speak some Chinese, enough to say what he wanted to say, and to understand most of everything that was said to him. She even taught him to read and make some of the ideographs, and he took care not to get her in the family way. And things started to get even better, too. He sometimes thought it was a good thing that mean, drunk son of a bitch had come after him with a knife. If he hadn't, he'd still be in the Cavite motor pool. Just about as soon as he arrived in Shanghai, he was assigned as an assistant truck driver on the regular supply convoys from Shanghai to Peking, where there was a detachment of Marines. There was at least one supply convoy a month, coinciding with the calling at Shanghai of the USS Chaumont or the USS Henderson, the Navy transports that endlessly circled the Pacific, bringing replacements and supplies and taking people home. Sometimes there was more than one truck convoy a month when freight arrived in Shanghai by Navy or civilian freighter. There was a driver and an assistant driver, both to share the driving and to leave a spare driver in case somebody got sick. And Sergeant Zimmerman drove a wrecker along. Even so, if for some reason a truck had to be left by the side of the road, even for a couple of hours because there was no one to drive it and the wrecker already had a truck in tow, by the time they could get a driver to it, there would be nothing left but the frame, and maybe not even that. China was like that. They drove first to Peking and then to Tinsin, another seaport, where there was a detachment of the 4th Marines, usually stopping over there for 2 days, and then back to Peking and then back to Shanghai. Some of the drivers hated getting the duty because it took them away from the good life in Shanghai, but some liked it because it was a change of scenery, or women, or both. Usually, Everly was pleased when his name came up on the roster, because it meant a change of scenery, not women. If something came up, he wasn't going to kick it out of bed, but he thought there was not much point in chasing strange females. You never knew what you might catch, and it was expensive. He was by nature, or perhaps by training, frugal. He had no money in his pockets from the time he became a ward of the state until he got his first pay as a Marine, and that left a painful memory. There was always an officer in charge of the convoys, changing from convoy to convoy, because that was the way things were in the Corps. When there were supplies involved, you had to have an officer in charge. But the officers were ordinarily wise enough to just ride along, leaving the actual running of the convoy to Sergeant Zimmerman. Zimmerman, who was short, stocky, and phlegmatic, had been in China for 6 years. He had a Chinese woman who had borne him 3 children, and he fully intended to spend the rest of his time in the Corps in China, then retire there and open a bar or something. Zimmerman was competent, and he was fair, and Everly figured him out, and how to deal with him, pretty quick. Zimmerman did what he was told without question and to the best of his ability, and he expected people who worked for him to do the same thing. When Sergeant Zimmerman told PFC Everly to do something, Everly did it, promptly and to the best of his ability. They got along. On the convoys, they came to spend time together, since neither was interested in chasing women, gambling, or getting shit-faced. In the spring of 1941, things changed. A new face appeared when the drivers and assistant drivers were gathered together for a convoy to Peking and Tinsin. Corporal Kenneth R. McCoy.
Everly knew him only by sight and reputation. McCoy had quite a reputation. PFC McCoy had become notorious, and in circumstances not unlike Everly's trouble with the mean, drunk son of a bitch off the Pennsylvania. In McCoy's case, it was Italian Marines, four of them, who ganged up on him one night when he was on his way back to the barracks. Killing a couple of Italian Marines was a bigger deal than cutting and stomping on the hand of a Marine sergeant. And when Everly heard they were going to court-martial McCoy, he thought McCoy was almost surely going where he had almost gone, to the Portsmouth Naval Prison. It wasn't a question of guilt or innocence, Everly reasoned, but rather what was more important. China Marine PFCs were expendable. When one caused trouble, and creating a diplomatic incident was far worse than getting in a knife fight with a sergeant, they got rid of him as quickly as possible. But that didn't happen. McCoy beat the court-martial, and the next thing you knew, he was promoted to corporal and transferred out of D Company to work in regimental headquarters. McCoy had just completed his first hitch in the Corps, and people just didn't get themselves promoted to corporal after just completing their first hitch. The scuttlebutt went around that McCoy was really working for Captain Edward Banning, the 4th Marines S2 officer in intelligence. The scuttlebutt was that McCoy had been in intelligence all along. Making sure that it didn't look like he was putting his nose in where it didn't belong, Everly watched McCoy pretty carefully on that first run to Peking. He noticed a couple of things. For one thing, McCoy not only spoke Chinese like a Chinaman, but had a couple of Japanese military manuals in his rucksack that he obviously could read. By the time they made 3 convoy trips to Peking, it was pretty clear to Everly that the officers in charge had gotten the word to do what Sergeant Zimmerman said to do, and that Zimmerman was getting that word from Corporal McCoy. It was also pretty clear that what McCoy was doing on the convoys was running around spying on the Japanese, identifying units, getting their strength, seeing what kind of weapons they had, and, by spending a lot of time in whorehouses, picking up from the Chinese whores what they had heard from their Japanese customers. And then, after one trip to Peking, right after they got back to Shanghai, Sergeant Zimmerman and Corporal McCoy disappeared. The scuttlebutt was that they got shipped home, but nobody knew for sure what had happened. And then, the week after they disappeared, Captain Banning sent for Everly and told him McCoy and Zimmerman had been ordered home. He also told him what McCoy had been doing for him, and that both McCoy and Zimmerman had spoken highly of him. Then, he asked him if he would be interested in volunteering to do the same thing. So Everly volunteered, guessing correctly that Banning was going to give him a lot more expense money than he was going to have to spend, and that it was a good way to make corporal ahead of time. And for a couple of months he did just that. He made corporal and managed to put aside nearly $1,000 in expense money. That business had ended when the decision was made to get the 4th Marines and the Navy's Yangtze River Patrol out of China. Captain Banning was assigned to the advance party and flown out of Shanghai to the Philippines, and Everly was sent back to the motor pool. Just before he left, Captain Banning married his Russian girlfriend, which raised him even higher, in Everly's opinion. When things got a little tough, a lot of Americans, officers and enlisted and civilians, had just cut their girlfriends, Chinese and Russian, loose to make out as best they could by themselves. Everly couldn't leave Su Ling to fend for herself, so he gave her all the money he had saved up since he was in China, and the money he'd made working for Banning. Then he told her to check on Mrs. Banning when the Japs came, and if she needed help, to do what she could for her and then go home. He didn't know what happened to Su Ling or Captain Banning's wife either, but he did know what happened to Captain Banning once he got to the Philippines. Just about as soon as the Marines came under fire, he was too close to an incoming round, and the concussion blinded him, and he wasn't even able to fight. For a while, he was in the hospital, first on Luzon, then here in the Corregidor hospital tunnel, and then they sent him and some other blind guys out on a submarine. and Percy Lewis Everly was promoted to sergeant and given the 2-gun, 30-caliber, water-cooled Browning machine gun section at Kindley Field. Where, he was convinced, one of several things was going to happen. Once Bataan fell, and the Japanese could bring their artillery to bear on the island, he was going to get killed by Japanese artillery. Or, in the unlikely event that didn't happen, he was going to get killed when the Japanese landed on Corregidor. Or, if he didn't get killed by Japanese artillery or by Japanese marine infantry when they landed on Corregidor, he was going to wind up a Japanese prisoner. He had seen enough of the Japanese in China to know how they treated prisoners. You were almost better off dead than to be a prisoner of the Japs. Everly had seen with his own eyes the Japs using Chinese prisoners for bayonet practice. The one thing Everly really couldn't figure out was why people, especially senior non-coms and officers, kept talking about the aid. The aid could be any number of things. For example, a fleet of B-17 bombers suddenly appearing to bomb the Japs off Bataan and out of the Philippines. Or a fleet of Navy ships carrying divisions of fully equipped soldiers from the States to run the Japanese off Bataan and out of the Philippines. Or even a small convoy of transports bringing food and medicine. But people kept talking about the aid, whatever it meant to them, as if it was really coming and would turn things around. That was bullshit, pure and simple. If the aid, any kind of aid, was coming, General MacArthur wouldn't have run off to Australia the way he did 3 weeks before, on 10 March. Only two things were going to happen to the men in the Philippines, Marines, soldiers, or sailors. They were going to get killed, or they were going to get captured. And getting captured was likely to be as bad as getting killed. Everly had seen people starve to death in China, too, and he didn't think he wanted to die that way, either. There was one other alternative. Take off now. Get the hell away from Corregidor and Bataan and Luzon. Make your way to one of the other islands, maybe Mindanao, and take off for the hills. That would be desertion in the face of the enemy, and the punishment for that was death or such other punishment as a court-martial may direct. There had been lectures about that. The lectures had convinced Everly that he wasn't the only one thinking about avoiding certain death or capture, that people had probably already taken off to do just that. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been the lectures telling them it was not only stupid, but punishable by death or such other punishment as a court-martial may direct. Everly had learned as a kid, even before he became a ward of the state, that the way to really get your teeth kicked in was to hope for something you really wanted. You usually didn't get what you really wanted. So he didn't let himself think that maybe the reason the first sergeant had sent for him was so that he could serve as interpreter for some officer going off Corregidor onto Bataan. If it turned out to be for some other reason, it would be a real kick in the face. An officer in the company CP was standing there, a young, skinny first lieutenant with a steel pod on his head, a web belt with a pistol holster hanging from it around his waist, and a Thompson 45 ACP submachine gun slung from his shoulder.
This is Sergeant Everly, Lieutenant, the first sergeant said.
Major Paulson tells me you speak pretty good Spanish, Sergeant, the lieutenant said.
Who the hell is Major Paulson? Oh. The little guy with the bad rash, running sores all over him, with pilot's wings. We spent 2 days last week on Bataan looking for parts for some kind of generator. We didn't find any. I could have told him we wouldn't before we left the rock. Yes, sir.
We really need those generator parts you and Major Paulson were looking for, the lieutenant said. Do you feel up to having another look?
Aye, sir.
My name is Weston, Sergeant, the lieutenant said, putting out his hand.
Yes, sir,
Everly said, shaking it. You need anything to take with you?
No, sir, Everly said.
He had with him all he would need. He had his Springfield Model 1903 30-06 caliber rifle with 6 extra 5-round stripper clips,
is model 1911 A1 45 ACP caliber Colt pistol and an extra magazine with 7 cartridges, 2 canteens of water, his compass, his first aid pack, and a small rucksack slung over his shoulder which held 2 shorts, 2 skivvy shirts, 2 pairs of socks, a shirt and a pair of pants, a razor with 3 decent blades and 1 brand new blade, 2 packages of Chesterfield cigarettes, and a Zippo lighter that wouldn't work until he could find a gas tank to dip it into for fuel. And the click-open knife the sergeant from the Pennsylvania had tried to kill him with. At the court-martial, the sergeant testified that the knife introduced into evidence didn't belong to him, that Everly had come after him with it. When Everly was acquitted, the knife was returned to him. The first thing he wanted to do was throw it away, but then he decided maybe he could sell it to someone for a couple of bucks. It was a high-quality knife. But then he realized that he didn't want to sell it either, so he just kept it hidden in his footlocker in rolled-up skivvy shorts. Later, when he was working for Captain Banning, he started carrying it with him in his pocket, or slipped it into the top of his boondockers. He never used it, not even to clean his fingernails, but he kept it sharpened, and every once in a while he oiled it and made sure that when he slid the button, it flipped open the way it was supposed to.
Then, why don't we get started?
Lieutenant Weston said.
Ah, sir.
The first sergeant didn't say a word. He just looked at Everly.
That old bastard is too smart to believe in the aid. He knows everybody on the Rock is fucked, and he knows men, and he knows me, which means he knows I wouldn't be carrying my rucksack unless I was thinking about not coming back. What does that make me in his eyes? A fucking coward and disgrace to the Marine Corps? Or a lucky bastard who's being given the chance to do something he wishes he could do himself?
Everly nodded at the first sergeant.
Take care of yourself, Everly,
the first sergeant said. Everly nodded again and then followed Lieutenant Weston out of the CP. Part 3. 1. Mariviles, Morong Highway, Luzon, Commonwealth of the Philippines, 1425 hours, 1 April 1942. No vehicles were available for assignment to a lowly lieutenant and his sergeant at the motor pool at Mariviles at the tip of the Bataan Peninsula.
You'll have to hitchhike, the army captain in charge said. But that's not as bad as it sounds. There's a lot of traffic. Where are you headed?
Orion, Lieutenant Weston said. Orion was one of 4 small towns on the Manila Bay side of the Bataan Peninsula.
When you leave the compound, turn right, the captain said. It's about 35 miles. What do you expect to find in Orion?
Generator parts?
Good luck,
the captain said, his tone clearly saying that 2 Marines had little chance of finding anything in Orion.
Thank you, sir,
Weston said, and saluted. Everly followed suit, and then courteously waited for Weston to leave the small frame motor pool office first. During the short trip from Corregidor on the requisitioned 35-foot Chriscraft cabin cruiser, there'd been a pleasant breeze, but by the time they'd walked from the Mariviles Pier to the motor pool, their backs and armpits were dark with sweat. At the gate of the compound, a guard shack was manned by 2 enlisted army military policemen and a captain wearing the cross rifles of infantry. He carefully examined the pass, actually a memorandum form, the stockpiled supplies on Corregidor having included 6 months' supply of printed forms, and Weston thought suspiciously.
"Where are you headed, Lieutenant?"
he asked.
"Morong, sir,"
Weston replied. The captain's eyebrows rose questioningly. It was clear he wanted an explanation.
"There was word that some stuff was cached this side of Morong when they evacuated Subic Bay,"
Weston said.
"We thought the generator parts we're looking for could be there."
He was uncomfortable lying, and he took a quick look at the old-breed sergeant from the 4th Marines to see if he had any reaction to his change of destination. Sergeant Everly had heard him tell the motor officer they were headed for Orion. Morong, a small port on the South China Sea, was on the opposite side of the Bataan Peninsula. Everly's face was expressionless.
"You've got coordinates?"
the captain asked.
Weston forced himself to smile.
200 paces due east from an overturned and burned ton and a half, he said. 3.7 miles from Morang.
There's more than one burned and overturned ton and a half truck on that road, the captain said.
Ours not to reason why, Weston said with a smile. Ours but to
happy hunting, the captain said, waving them through the gate.
There was no traffic headed toward Subic Bay. Weston started walking along the side of the road, remembering when he used to hitchhike in high school and college. He could never understand then, or now, why hitchhikers walked along the road.
There's no way you could walk even a couple miles to where you're headed, so why walk at all? Just wait for a ride.
Everly walked behind him, keeping up with him easily, despite all the equipment he was carrying. Weston decided he would at least walk out of sight of Marivilis before talking to the sergeant. And then, when they were out of sight, he decided he would walk a little farther. He intended to order the sergeant to go back to the rock, carrying a meaningless message to Major Paulson. He had just about decided they had gone far enough, being defined as far enough away from Marivilis that if the sergeant became suspicious and said something to the MPs at the gate, he would have 20 minutes or so to find a side road and disappear down it, when the sergeant reported a truck was approaching. It was a flatbed Ford, driven by an army corporal. The name of a Manila furniture dealer could still be read under a hastily applied coat of olive drab paint. A PFC riding in the cab stepped out and gave Weston his seat, and then climbed in back with Everly. The truck was loaded with bales of empty sandbags, and the driver told him he was headed for a Philippine artillery battalion, then asked him where he was headed.
"I'm looking for a burned and rolled over ton and a half," Weston replied. "There's supposed to be some stuff cached nearby."
"I was up there this morning," the driver said. "There's a bunch of trucks turned over and burned. How are you going to know which one?"
"I suppose I'll have to check them all out and hope I get lucky," Weston replied.
15 minutes later, on a sharp bend on a deserted stretch of road, the driver slowed and stopped and pointed out Weston's window. The fire-blacked wheels and underside of an overturned truck were just visible 30 yards off the road at the bottom of a ditch.
"I guess he missed the turn," the driver said. "At night, no lights, these roads are dangerous as hell."
Might as well start here, I suppose. Thanks for the ride."
The sergeant was standing by the side of the road, looking at Weston, by the time Weston got out of the cab. Weston walked to the side of the road and, nearly falling, slid down into the ditch. After a moment, as if making up his mind whether or not to do so, Everly slid down after him. Weston pretended to examine the truck, and then walked down the ditch 100 feet or so. Everly watched him, but did not follow. Weston walked back to him.
"Obviously, this isn't the truck," he said.
Everly said nothing.
"I've been thinking, Sergeant,"
Weston said, wondering if he sounded as artificial as he felt.
"We better get word to Major Paulson that chances are we aren't going to find the truck at all."
Everly didn't reply.
"Tell him, of course, that I'll keep looking," Weston said.
"Could I see that Thompson a minute, please, sir?"
Everly asked. It was not the response Weston expected, and without really thinking what he was doing, he unslung the submachine gun from his shoulder and handed it to Everly. Everly unslung his Springfield 03 and handed it to Weston.
"Sergeant, what are you doing?"
Weston asked.
"Lieutenant, I'm trying to figure out what to do about you," Everly said.
"Excuse me?"
"I'm not going back to the rock, Mr. Weston," Everly said. "I made up my mind about that a couple of days ago. If I ever got off the rock, I wouldn't go back."
"What are you going to do?"
"I don't really know. Get off Bataan somehow. Go to one of the other islands. Mindanao, probably."
Weston didn't know what to say.
"And I decided I'm going to need this more than you do," Everly added,
shrugging the shoulder from which the Thompson was suspended.
"Would you give me the extra magazines, please?"
"What do you think you're going to do, even if you make it to Mindanao?"
"I'm not the only one who's decided he doesn't want to surrender," Everly said. "Maybe I can link up with some of the others."
"And do what?"
"I don't know.
Maybe do something about the Japs. Maybe try to get out of the Philippines. The only thing I know for sure is that I'm not going to find myself a prisoner.
Their eyes met.
You sure you know what you're doing?
The only thing I know for sure, Everly repeated, is that I'm not going to find myself a prisoner. I've seen what the Japs do to their prisoners.
The reason I was sending you back to the Rock, Weston said slowly, is that I had reached much the same conclusion.
I figured maybe that was it when I heard you bullshit them officers, Everly said.
I'm a pilot, Weston said. If I can get to Australia, I can do some good. I'm not doing anybody any good here.
Everly nodded, but did not reply.
Do you have any idea how we can get from here to Mindanao? Weston asked.
Everly shook his head slowly from side to side.
Except that we're going to need a boat, he said.
Do you have any idea where we can get a boat?
Everly shook his head again. Weston smiled. Well, we'll think of something, he said, and held out Everly Springfield to him. With the other hand, he prepared to take his Thompson back.
You ever fire a Thompson much, Mr. Weston?
Only in basic officer's course, Weston replied, for familiarization.
I got a Thompson expert bar, Everly said. Maybe I better keep it.
The expert bar is one of the specific weapon bars, the others being pistol, rifle, etc., attached to the expert marksman's medal.
That's not a suggestion, nor even a request. It is an announcement that he has taken over the Thompson.
If you think that's the smart thing to do, it's all right with me, Weston said, and handed Everly the two spare magazines Major Paulson had given him.
Did I do that because it was the logical thing to do? Or because there's something about this man that frightens me, and I didn't want to have the balls to challenge him?
The way I figure it, we're maybe 9-10 miles from Morong, Everly said. I don't think it would be smart going into Morong looking for a boat, but maybe we could find something a little out of town, maybe a mile or so, either side of Morong. There's little coves or whatever they're called.
And you speak Spanish, Weston said, thinking aloud.
Everly grunted an acknowledgement.
And I have $5,000, Weston said, with a touch of enthusiasm in his voice.
Everly quickly dispelled it.
If we get caught by the army snooping around looking for a boat, we better hope your boat pass works.
You think that's liable to happen?
I don't think we're the only ones trying to get away from Bataan, Everly said matter-of-factly. And what we're doing is desertion in the face of the enemy.
Is that how you think of it?
That's what it is, Mr. Weston, Everly said, and then turned and started up the side of the ditch, back toward the road.
After Weston climbed up after him, Everly had something else to say.
I think it would be a good idea, Mr. Weston, if we split your $5,000, in case we get separated or something.
Weston didn't like the suggestion, if it was a suggestion, but he took out the envelope and counted out $2,500 and handed it to Everly. He found a little consolation in the thought that if Everly wanted to steal the money, all he had to do was point the Thompson at him and take it.
Thanks, Everly said.
He removed his canteens from their covers, divided the money into two stacks, shoved it into the canteen cases, and then, with some difficulty, replaced the canteens. Then he started walking down the road. Weston walked after him, very much aware that he was no longer functioning as a Marine officer in command of an enlisted man. Everly had taken command. It was not a comforting thought.
On the other hand, this old-breed China Marine seems to know what he's doing, and obviously I don't.
2. The village on the coast was at the end of a winding dirt road, not much more than a trail. It consisted of no more than 15 crude houses surrounding a well. The houses were built on stilts, obviously as protection against surf and high tides. Some were roofed with galvanized steel, others with thatch. Weston wondered why they didn't build their houses farther away from the water. The shoreline was mostly dirt and rocks, onto which boats could have been beached. No boats were in sight, however, and no marks were on the shoreline indicating any had been in there.